Early in the morning, rising to the street. Throw me on that necktie, strap wingtips on my feet. Got to find a reason she was wrong. Got to find a reason, the client's money's all gone. Always on my iPad, always got Wi-Fi. I can play this jury like a motherfucking riot.
Good morning, everyone, to this episode of the Justice Team Podcast. I'm Brad Simon, your host for today, and we have a very interesting topic that we get a lot, which is, hey, you guys have a big law firm now. How did you get started? And this week, we have a lot of special guests that started their own law firm, and some current employees that were on the defense side had their own law firm, joined us, and some that still have their own law firm. But first, we'd like to introduce this special drink made by a special lady who I've literally known all my life and maybe a little bit before, my mom, Linda Simon.
Yes.
There you go. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this drink and why you're liquoring us up at 9 a.m.
Well, I'm liquoring you guys up.
In the microphone.
I'm sorry. I'm liquoring you guys up at 9 a.m. because my son, Robert, asked me to make a special drink for this morning's podcast. My son, Brandon, asked me to make Bloody Marys, and I said, if I can't pull that off, you're getting an Irish coffee. He said, great choice, even better. So here you go, guys. Enjoy.
Thanks, Mom, for the Irish coffee.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you.
So we're going to go around the room and introduce the members of this week's podcast. We'll start to my farthest right. Jenny, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Jenny Anglin, and I've been at the Simon Law Group for about 2.5 years. Prior to that, I had a long and sordid history in the defense.
Speaking of long and sordid, the next person we'd like to introduce is...
Mauro Fiore. Hello, good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation to be on this incredible panel. And, you know, I've been around a long time. You know, I think most people know me. I've been a plaintiff lawyer for 20 years and rocking and rolling every day.
Rocking and rolling. He was almost late today because he got a ticket. What did you get a ticket for this morning?
Oh, I got a carpool lane violation ticket, but I figure I owe the state one because I've done that 500 times without being caught. So finally, they got me. So
state bar, if you're listening, Mauro Fiore. Yeah,
if that's what's going to take me down, man, God bless him.
Next is Sam Arjovsky.
Hi. Yeah, my name's Sam, and co-founded a law firm, Bergner Murjovsky, with a good friend of mine, James Bergner. You know, it's been a long road, and we've got a brand that we've built up, and good stuff. So it's an honor to be here, guys. I'm among some great people here.
So Sam has his own podcast called Sam Nation, hashtag Sam Nation, which he will probably be recording himself later this afternoon or this morning.
Did that inspire you guys?
It was part of our inspiration. I started listening to yours, and I was like, wow, if Sam can do it, literally anyone can do it.
That's true. 100%.
And next to Sam's left is my little brother, Brandon Simon.
Hello, hello. Brandon, I've been with the Simon Law Group since it was incepted. Actually, it was before it was the Simon Law Group. It was the law offices of Robert T. Simon, and it was just Bob and I in a little suite sharing an office together. So I've been here since we started. Been a fun ride.
And last and certainly least.
I'm Ryan Conger. I was on the defense side like Jenny for a number of years and went out on my own in 2015. Started my own practice and doing all plaintiff personal injury. And the last, I don't know, number of months I've been working with the Simon Law Group pretty closely, consulting, helping screen cases, and working on some big ones. A ton of fun.
So usually we do a little fun, the Family Feud style top 10, but today is going to be a little bit different because everyone has their own unique perspective on why I started a law firm or why I don't have a law firm, and there's a lot of stress with it, and there's a lot of good times and bad times, and we're going to talk about that because, like I said earlier, a lot of the questions we get is how do you start, when do you start, what decisions, when's the right time? So, you know, I'm going to start with Brandon, my brother, because he actually was start, like he said, he started the Simon Law Group before it was the Simon Law Group, before I jumped ship to create the Simon Law Group, before he even went to law school. Brandon.
So Robert, our other brother, the trial attorney, were you still working with Bob at Letter and Ojima when he went out on his own?
No, I was doing mortgage, real estate, defense.
So
kill myself.
Sounds scintillating.
Oh yeah, tell me more, Mauro.
So,
I'm always good for the story.
I was just finishing up undergrad, and I had no plans. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was probably just going to stick around in D.C. and.
That's the District of Columbia.
Yeah, that's where we went to undergrad. And Bob called me up one day, and he said, you know, I don't know why he asked my advice.
Wait, you got to do Bob's voice. Wait, I'll do Bob's voice.
Okay.
Hey, I'm Bob.
So Bob called me one day. I remember I was kind of walking home. I was working for a law firm in undergrad, and he called me and said, hey, I'm thinking about going out on my own. And I don't know why he asked me, because I was a 22-year-old kid getting drunk on Bud Ice still, so I didn't know what to do. And he said, yeah, I need, if you want to come out and help me, you know, start my solo practice. I'm bringing in a lot of cases. I think I can do it. So I literally the day after, I don't even think I went to my commencement ceremony. I just packed up and moved to California with Bob, moved into the condo with him. And we had a little office, probably as big as this room. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. It was we didn't even know how to work a copier. We didn't know what we were doing, but Bob was bringing in a lot of cases, and
So let's talk about seed money, and seed money is kind of this.
Bob got his seed money from a game show,
and that's not a joke.
So he was on Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader, and that was kind of
the catalyst of how he got a lot of just cash, and instead of using that cash to do fun stuff, he invested in himself and invested in Brandon, and then they were 9 months into the law offices of Robert T. Simon, and these two knuckleheads couldn't figure out how to write a motion, and I'm sitting there writing motions all day long.
Yeah, Brad sat us down. I was like, what are you guys doing? So I think I remember sitting at a bar in Brentwood, Q's, and we had lunch with Brad, and Bob convinced him to quit his job and form the Simon Law Group, and then I went off to law school, and those guys kind of took it off in the stratosphere while I was in law school.
Yeah, it was a hard decision for me. I know probably everyone in this room, it was a very tough decision to make the leap from working a W-2 to jumping and doing something on your own where you maybe get paid. Because in our business, it's not like we're making hourly money where you get paid by a client every month. You get paid maybe, and you get paid in the future. So I took a leap of faith where I was making a really good salary. I did like my job. I liked litigating. I liked winning. Even though it was mostly throwing people out of their homes, I was winning, but it was pretty soulless. Where that was what the prize was, hey, you won this motion, and all these people got to get out of their house. So when Bob talked to me, I said, okay, let's do it. And he had some money, and I had no money, and that was the perfect marriage. Isn't that every marriage, Mauro?
I'll tell you, have you ever met a defense lawyer with a soul?
Ooh.
Yeah, I think I have. You have?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know. I still haven't met one. Most of them are, you know, they go home at night to their apartment and their Docker suit that they bought at TJ Maxx, and they put it on again the next day for nothing, for just to people. That's all that's their life. So when I go home and I sit in my living room and I look at the city view, and I think, wow, how lucky am I to help people, right?
Let's talk about Mauro's story. Mauro was grew up very poor, Mexican, Italian, and one day dreamed about getting up on the hill and never thought he'd get there. Now look at him. He's actually sitting on top, looking over. And how did you get to where you are? Because it's kind of impressive, your background.
I kind of have a story like Brandon's, except that we can just leave out the college part, because I didn't go to college, which is amazing. California has some amazing rules, and this is before the internet, so it was like hard for anyone to figure that out, but I was a caddy at a golf course in Palm Springs, And I was had nothing to do one night, so I went. And I was 20 years old.
But I thought you weren't allowed within 500 feet of kids. Was this like an adult golf course?
There was supervision at all times.
Joking. We're joking.
Yes.
He's allowed to be around children.
Yes.
He's having a kid.
Yeah, my wife's pregnant.
Congratulations. December.
Is it yours?
I think so. I think so.
I thought you guys said inviting Mauro would make this more exciting.
But, it is.
But no, I was a caddy at a golf course in Palm Springs, and this was like in the early 90s, and I had nothing to do one night. I went to a Barnes & Noble, and I'm like, man, I got to do something with my life, man. I don't know. Caddying is really not, you know. I was like Bill Murray in Caddyshack. So I went into the aisle of the bookstore that said like career, you know, books, right? I was like, oh man, I gotta find a career, you know? So then I pulled out a book that said be a lawyer. I'm like, okay. So I'm looking at this lawyer book, and on the back it said non-traditional law schools, and I'm like, well man, I'm kind of non-traditional, you know? So then I looked it up, and it said in California had all these crazy rules where you don't have to go to law school, you don't have to go to college, you have to do it, you just have to just pass the bar. I was like, well, I think I can pass the bar, you know, I have a strong academic record of 2.0 in high school. So I called up one of these schools that was in Inglewood at the end of the runway. So like every 15 minutes in class, like we'd have to like take a break because the building would shake so much and it was so loud from all the planes. But it was at the end of the runway in Inglewood, University of West Los Angeles, who took me literally off the street. And 3 years later, I passed the bar. Shocking, even to everybody. All my friends that I went to high school with are like, you're a lawyer? I'm like, yeah, I can't believe it either. And I was like 23 years old when I passed the bar. So that's
so.
My
so did you, when you came out and you're a lawyer, are you like, does anyone even want to hire you? Or were you forced to open your own law firm?
Yeah,
or was it someone's going to hire
actually,
you?
I actually got a job because I had a friend of mine that I went to West LA law school with. Which, by the way, is where Gary Dordick went to law school. And Gary has a similar academic record to mine. None. Besides the law degree.
This is an interesting concept, everyone. That some of the best trial lawyers that are around in the country are usually the B or C students that somehow just have a knack for connecting with people, and that's not reflected on standardized testing.
You know the joke, right?
What's the joke, Sam?
Well, there's the one that everybody tells, right? The one about the A's. A students, what do? They teach, right? B students, you know, they go and work, and then C students make all the money. Well, the variation on that is that the after law school, A students teach the B students how to work for C students.
There you go. And
right?
That's probably pretty accurate.
And it's pretty accurate. It's certainly in, you know, what I've experienced, so... You don't want to get too high of grades in law school, kids. You know,
that's really lower
a cautionary
your
tale.
That's lower your standards a little
but,
bit.
But however, though, there's a caveat to that. I did graduate like number two in my class at University of West Los Angeles.
There's two people in the class, right?
There might have been 50, yeah, but
that's
I was
really
no,
good.
That's awesome.
I was very high up there. You know, very high up there. It was a very strong group. I think when we all took the bar, like four people passed.
Wow.
Yeah, which is that's pretty good for an unaccredited law school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when's the last time a client asked you what your grades were in
never,
law school?
Never.
Or where you went to school.
Or even where you
I've
went to
had
law
people,
school.
Once in a while, someone will ask me where I went to law school, like maybe once a year, and I just laugh.
You never heard of it.
Yeah. Small school.
But I think having common sense like that, you know what plays on the street. I've watched guys sit and read a book and come up with ideas and – You know, especially when I was on the defense side, and I would look and go, man, that's not really going to play in front of a jury. You know, but they get really confident in some of those theories that they come up with in the lab. But I don't think that stuff's going to play on the street.
So, Sam, you have built one of the biggest law firms in Orange County. And this has taken – how long – when did you guys start, like, put your shingle up? When did that happen?
It would have been – the first week of January in 2004.
Wow.
So, but when you think about it, though, that's not that long ago, right? That's 14 years, 15 almost. But the story's funny because, you know, I had known James for some years before that. We were friends. I met him his first year of law school. And I was working at a PI firm that is now defunct and out of business. But it was hot, you know, stuff back then, and it had a brand, and, you know, and they were getting a lot of business. And by virtue of that, I think I had some credibility, even though I really didn't know what I was doing. And I met James, and he was, you know, a first year law student at Whittier. And I said, "What are you going to do after law school?" And he goes, "I don't know. I have no idea." I go, "You should do PI. PI is awesome. It's fun. You know, you're helping people and you can make money doing it. It's crazy." He goes, "Okay." And to James's credit, he was just crazy enough to believe me. So we kept up with our, you know, with our planning. And 3 years, you know, later, 3.5 years later, we opened the office, and it was, you know, seed money. I had this marketing business that was producing cash, but it was, you know, Robbie over there smiling. It was making money in workers' comp, and anybody here who practiced in workers' comp in the mid 2000s knows it was good, and it was about to go bad.
Oh, and I could tell you some stories.
Yeah, I know. And the key thing in business is knowing when to get in and knowing when to get out. And it was the right time to get out. So you know, instead of spending all that cash, I just put it into the firm, and it was the best investment I ever made. And it was, I'll tell you guys, it's not easy. And, you know, James had at that time, he was working basically between two other places. And, you know, I was running the office, and we were slowly hiring and firing people. And it was, you know, it just took a lot of work, a lot of fine tuning, a lot of tweaking to get to where we are here.
So where you are now, how many, you guys have this big, beautiful building up over in Newport. How many employees do you guys have now?
About 90.
90, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at 41, 42 right now, and I feel that that's a little uncontrollable for me, and you're back there managing it all.
It's the most important thing is scaling, right? So the challenge you have when you've got a practice you start out, it's very familial, even if you're not actually related to one another. It's just comfortable, it's easy, and it starts to grow. And usually it's around that 25 to 35 body mark is when it becomes unwieldy. If you haven't set up teams, if you haven't set up middle management. At 50, if you don't have a strong middle management team, people that, you know, you have as lieutenants between yourself and, let's say, entry level or junior level staff, you're gonna have pandemonium breakout. But if you start building that team, you know, somewhere after that 30, 35 people mark, as you're approaching 50, and all you guys know that have done this, then all of a sudden you can grow to 200, you can grow to 300, you can grow to multiple offices, because in that pool of people you've developed talent that you can trust, in fact, to lead an office solo. So I think there's a way to do that for sure.
And that takes a lot of – how much of your time, Sam, is administrative versus legal?
It's all administrative.
Yeah.
100%. But, you know, it's interesting because that's really where a lot of the money is. You know, you've a lot of guys are great – there are a lot of great lawyers out there who are, I think, not very successful commercially, right? And the reason – and I'll also say, I think there's quite a few lawyers that aren't that great lawyers, but they're very successful. And it's in part because they know how to inspire people. They know how to get, not just find A players, but squeeze A work out of them. You can hire an A player, but getting them to produce A work all of the time, that's tricky. And I've had people tell me flat out, you can't do it. And I found that you actually can, and I, you know, we've developed a few tricks along the way to do that.
Well, I just want to congratulate you on your success. Watching this team grow is phenomenal. It's we've tried to, like, some of the little things I've seen in your office, we try to mimic because it works, and the way you motivate people, just like you said, it's not always financial. It's also there's fun stuff.
We did it financially for years. We would give people a cut, you know, we'd give them percentages. And it really just put us in the poorhouse, right? And because, you know, the minute – you know how this business works, guys. You know, you the little stuff pays the bills. The big stuff, you get to maybe, you know, take something home. Well, when the big stuff would come through, all of a sudden this giant but a bunch of it was just going out the door, you know, in a check to the to whoever's working the file. So we, you know, we it turns out that recognition is just as powerful as money. So we pay people well, but we fixed salaries, and turns out that people are working for you for a reason, right? They're working and not starting their practice because they want a steady paycheck.
So let's talk about that, because
well,
Jenny,
you know,
Anglin,
I just wanted to say one thing about his office, because as I'm known to do, I snoop around this town looking for slip and fall cases. And, so I might have snooped around their office once or twice looking at slip and fall cases. And the first time I went there, I remember I went back to my office, I think, the next day, and I told one of the associates in my office, I said, man, I thought I'd seen everything, you know? And you go to his office, and the way that it's set up and the technology, and it just... It really blew my mind. Truly,
it's revolutionary, and it was thinking
it's out of this world.
It's not look at this stuffy law firm with books on the wall. It's high tech and people with headsets and ticker boards, and it's working. And
like nobody had a pen, or
we don't let them have pens.
Like nobody had a pen or paper.
Have you seen the movie Gross Point Blank?
Yeah,
no one's allowed to have a pen.
Completely paperless, like. There was not, I mean, it's like an Apple store. It was perfect. Everything was just, it was crazy.
It looks like it's a magazine, yeah. Not a law firm.
Oh, you're
and there's, yeah, it was pretty impressive. And
so we're going to try to move along because we have limited time. We got a lot of really good stories to get to. Now, Jenny is someone who was on the defense side, opened her own law firm, and then came on and joined our team. So that's kind of a unique situation where someone who had it and then said, I don't want to do this anymore. And Jenny, why don't you go into why and how and what the benefit is?
Okay, well, I had only been in practice by myself for about a year and a half, and I was doing really well. And honestly, I had no designs to change or shift gears. But to be honest, like, if Bob Simon emails you and says, hey, what are you doing? It's like, well, okay, well, I always said if I ever switched, it would be like to work with Bob. That was it. So... It still took like a huge leap for me to make that decision, though, even though I knew I'd be working for like one of the top law firms in California. I had just established my business and the money was coming in and I had really good clients. And so it took a huge leap for me to do that. But the trade-off I knew was going to be obviously working for the best firm around. And also I was really hopeful that I would have a better work-life balance, which I did not have when I was on my own. It was just the minute I stopped doing the legal work, I started doing the administrative side, and I would put my kids to bed and start working again. And I was getting no sleep, and you can't say no to the work that's coming in, because if you say no, you're cutting off that source potentially. So it was the best decision to come here. And I can understand why people go out on their own, but now that I've done both, I've much preferred the team life.
So, you know, Ryan Conger has a similar situation where he was on the defense side with a partner at one of the biggest defense firms, making good money and good bonuses. And why'd you stop?
It was always my plan, really, from the beginning. I always wanted to do plaintiff personal injury, and I always wanted to be on my own. That was the path I took. I got some pretty good advice from my uncle, my dad's brother.
That's usually how uncles work.
he's a pretty
successful. It could be Uncle Sam.
He's a successful plaintiff attorney, and he said, look, go do – he did insurance defense for the first 5 or 6 years of his career, and he said, go do that. It's good to learn how the enemy thinks from the inside. So
narc.
So I did, and it was always my plan, and I think, you know, you mentioned seed money earlier, and I think that was the thing. It took me a while. When you're at that age, you're in your 20s and you're trying to get on your feet, it just took me a while to save up enough money and get the balls to do it. And so I got to a point where I had, you know, 50 grand or something. I refinanced my house, and so I had a line of equity, and I said, okay, I have enough money to live for the next year and a half, even if I don't get, even if I don't make anything, and made the jump. It was the best decision I ever made.
And I think a lot of people probably have that plan. I'm going to start defense work, you know, learn it, get a seat, get some seed money, go out on my own. But a lot of people get stuck and stay
This goes to the first. We got a listener email, and it's, Mr. Simon, I'm thinking about starting my own practice right out of law school. What do you think about that? Is that too risky? Now, it sounds like someone like Sam, who you guys, did you guys jump right into your own thing right out of law school?
Right away.
Okay. And then, like myself, I didn't. And I always, Bob didn't.
I always wonder that. Like, had I not worked at a firm, I don't know how I would have figured out how to practice law.
Well, you know, I worked at a firm for about a year. And the guy that I worked for ended up getting disbarred because... he was just,
because of the work you were doing.
Well, he was just stealing. He was just stealing out of the trust account and snorting the rest of it up his nose. So it was a rough place to work. So I was thrown into, like, I literally ran the office myself because the guy I worked for was a disaster. So after a year where I kind of got to, I learned from one of his paralegals a little bit about how to do work in the PI business. And then I said, well, if I'm going to, first of all, I don't want to get disbarred. This guy's going down. I'm going to get out of here. But I knew just a little teeny bit that I learned from that paralegal that I was able to start my own office about a year after I got out of school.
So how many years have you been doing your own thing, Mauro?
Since 2000.
Since 2000,
I got out of school in 98. I worked about a year and a half, and then in 2000 I opened my own office, which I was a solo for a while. And you know, like anything, you have to get lucky. I got lucky. I hit some good cases. Literally... cases that just fell out of the sky. I got some good settlements early, and I expanded, and now I have about 25 employees. There's five lawyers, and
how many trials have you yourself done?
Almost 50. As a matter of fact, wow. This is a good question. I've gotten two verdicts in the last 10 days. I never tried two cases in 10 days. I tried jury trials. I tried one, and both of them I ended up in Pasadena. The first one was a, you know, these cases, you just can't, you know, they sicken me. They offered $3,000 to my client, State Farm, on a good case. The lady had one epidural. They wanted to pay $3,000. So I tried the case in 3 days, and passed in, I got a $42,000 verdict.
Wow. Congratulations. Okay. See, so not a lot of people at your level are going to take, I got $3,000 in meds. Or how much was her meds?
She had one epidural, like $16,000.
And you're going to go... because they're just making you an insulting offer instead of folding. You're like, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you just got to take, you just, you know, once in a while you got to do it. So then the next day I report to Department 1. I get sent back to Pasadena with Oldendorf, who's a great plaintiff judge. And I try this other case. This was a slip and fall, a trip and fall.
Of course.
Yeah, against Edison. Yeah, of course. Against Edison for a negligent construction site. Where they sent me a 9, they were very generous. They sent a 998 for $5,000 on this one.
Wow.
A 998, no less. So I tried that case, and I got the verdict yesterday, $72,000 on $12,000 in meds. But, you know, so these are just, you know, and I always tell people, I don't need any more experience. I always have this conversation with Dordick, who's one of my best friends, probably my best friend in the world. I always tell Gary, I don't need any more experience. I've tried so many cases. I just need to try some better ones once in a while, you know?
So the money you probably earned on those two verdicts maybe just make you make your payroll, but you're doing those on principle.
That's 100%. Just for fun, just to slap these lawyers around. I mean, the guy from Edison, I don't think he really – he was waiting for me to go in the courtroom to see what side I sat on before he sat down, because I don't think he knew what side he was supposed to sit on. You know what I mean? So, like, this guy was ridiculous. So some of these guys are so bad that they assign to these smaller cases that it's just fun to mess with them. Now, when I was when I used to have cases against Jenny, she was very tough. She never wanted to pay me shit.
Oh, that's not true. I always overpaid.
That's what she offered you, but she probably didn't.
I probably had, like, 20, 30 cases with her. I mean, I had a lot of cases with her over the years. Never wanted to pay up. Then finally I took her out to dinner, and then, you know,
flowers.
After that, the money started flowing.
We had one case I remember it was against Jenny, and I remember the case still. It was, her last name was like Savage or something.
Yo, that was a bad
and that
case.
Was it was a hard because we didn't know what happened, and then Jenny and I are like, the police report was wrong, and all these witness statements just didn't match up, And I remember – now I remember where that accident happened because I have to drive through there to get to our Hermosa Beach office all the time. I'm like, man, this intersection is confusing.
Yeah.
But I just remember her being like, let's see – and this was odd for a defense attorney who just wants to bill by the hour was, hey, let's take a look and try to see what really happened here and try to work on a settlement. Like that makes sense early on. And I think we got something that made sense, whereas most people – my first boss, Ron Raup, he was like – you know, the client, let's do what's in the best interest of the client and look at the case and call up the plaintiff lawyer and say, what do you guys really want? Like, let's talk about, let's work from the back forward and just see what do you want? How do we get there? And let's get it resolved. And I think some of the better defense attorneys are really like that. Like Brandon, you've encountered some of those guys that just call you up and say, hey, what do you need? What do you need from us? Or what do we need to give you to get this resolved?
Flat fears. Right?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I always thought I'm representing the insured. You know, that's my primary duty is to represent the insured when I was on the defense side. So I was just trying to get that guy out of harm's way. Right? And I mean, so you got to make sure you have enough authority to do that. That's when you called up the plaintiff lawyer. You wanted cases against me because I would have called you up and said, hey, what can I do to get this insured? Well,
there's some defense lawyers that work like that still. You know, I've dealt with some.
I thought they didn't have souls, Mauro.
Actually, there's a few that do now. I sometimes go a little overboard. Some of them, actually, I'm friends with a couple of. Well, I'm actually really good friends with a prominent defense attorney. I won't mention his name because I don't want anyone to know that. But there's a big
ooh, Mauro, after dark. All right, we'll go to the next question. It says Bob, and I'm Brad, but they always assume it's Bob. Bob, how much money should we have before starting a law firm? Isn't litigation very expensive? Sam, how expensive is running a law firm in litigation?
Great question. Why litigate right from the get-go, right? That question assumes that you're going to litigate every file, which of course you're not. Your model has to be one where you're willing to settle cases and capable of settling cases pre-lit, which produces revenue in a quicker, obviously, one, and with less cost advance outlay. How much money do you need? I don't know. I mean, we did it honestly. We probably invested somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 100K in the first year, of money from this other business that I had. And it worked just fine. I think you can even do it with less. I think you can start at very low fi. One of the great things right now, very equalizing now, is the internet. And I don't know how much longer it's going to remain equalizing. Back when, you know, Mauro was starting and others, you had to be in the Yellow Pages, right? It was like Yellow Pages.
I had a double truck ad.
What's a double truck?
It's when you open it up and it's on both sides.
I mean, and they would charge, it'd be like $7,000 whatever a month for a double truck ad. And then they'd have like, they would do, I mean, and it was the dying days of the Yellow Pages, but before the internet was really the place where clients went to get business. So you're either in the Yellow Pages or you're, TV or radio, which is prohibitively expensive. Now a smart, young or new solo practitioner can go out and can create a web page. If he knows anything about SEO, he can optimize his site to be picked up. In certain places, he can play the social media game, and a little bit of hustle and a little bit of smarts can go a long way in producing a few cases a month. And a few cases, 3 to 5 cases a month, can get you started, and you're going to settle a couple of them in the first, let's say, 90, 120 days, and you'll see. You'll start to pick up revenue. I think You're just go for it. Do it. If you're thinking about it, do it.
You mentioned kind of, you said what, 50 to 100 or something in that range to get started. And I think that's what we had or what Bob had when we got started. And it was, we were doing some pre-lit, some litigation. And I think you're right, Sam. You got to look at those early cases when you take them in and say, we got to be smart about what we're going to invest in this case to make it profitable for us, but also worthwhile for the client, where their settlement isn't getting eaten up by a massive amount of costs.
Yeah, I think I had similar $50 to $100.
Similar. But that was the year 2000.
It was very similar.
That's back when I was graduating high school. Just kidding.
You have to be careful about what kind of cases you take, too. I think you want to have a good mix of cases. Maybe you can afford to take one or two big, long-shot cases that are going to take a while, but you also want to take some you know, lower policy, easy cases that are going to settle fast.
Yeah, minimal policy to a firm with no overhead.
If you're solo, if you're by yourself, you got to know, you know, hey, if I've got a full slate at 15 or 20 cases if I'm handling them all by myself, and you want to have a good mix.
So two things on that. One, you either as a solo guy or as a big practice, there's such a thing as too many cases.
Yes.
Right? Too many cases will bury you, and pretty soon cash flow is going to suffer because you're not moving them through. And the other point is, as far as quality, you never turn down a great big case. If you're a solo guy, you just started, you got this great big case, what you do is you call the Simons, right?
And that's the other great
you equalizer. You have a litigation firm come in and you get the credit. You know, you don't realize you get the credit for it. You know, you could be on all the pleadings and they'll walk you through what they're doing. They're really good here and some
and
other
we,
places
we
too.
We started out doing that where we had a couple cases where we had enough seed money, but not enough. We have to retain 8 experts. So early on, we associated in cases like Mike Alder's firm and Brian Panish's firm, and we started learning from them how to do it, but also we couldn't handle it. So a lot of the people that have cases right now that are – one of the emails is, what happens if the case is too big? How do you finance that? There are finance companies that will give you loans against kind of your portfolio when they file UCC1s, but you have to have 5 years of business under your belt usually, and you get a certain line of credit. But – really, it's pretty – you'll probably make more money associating in a litigation and trial firm that can bankroll the case, do the work. You learn how to do it. And we did that. Bob tried a case with Brian Panish, and I was there every day with him with Spencer Lucas. And Spencer and I are in the back just typing things on a computer, telling them what to say, and they're up there just crushing. And Bob and I looked at each other and said, I think we can do this. And that case hit really big, and we had enough money where we said, let's just start hiring people. So we hired our first attorney, Tom Fair, and now he's winning major awards. And we're going into our 10th year. You're going into your 15th year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Mauro's going into his 40th year.
Yeah. I feel like 100.
You look it, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's Bob and your mantra is – because that's how we started. I specifically remember when – I don't know if it was that Cedillo case, but it was another big case where actually Mike, the first time we met Mike Alder, he came in. And I specifically remember him sitting with the two of you and talking to
and
you
I was
about
like, why am I going to give up a certain percentage of my fee to bring you in? And Mike said, I'm going to make your case 50% better.
And you're going to learn.
And Mike made our case 50% better.
If not more.
And I was like, wow, like I had a really good settlement on like a motorcycle wrongful death case. And I used that money we got on that. I bought my first house.
And he also gives you the tools to do it on your own. That's kind of what we preach now. Is that that's how Bob learned under Panish. You know, you do a trial with Panish and you learn from the best. They also bankroll your case because you can't afford it, but they also teach you how to do it on your own. You know, teach a man to fish. And that's kind of what we do.
The
in
old
our
parable. Thank you.
I did some reading before I came this morning.
Light reading. I saw that in the bathroom.
And then
the Bible.
That's not light reading. The Bible. No. So that's kind of what we do now. Is we encourage people that bring us cases to be involved in the case, and they learn if they want to try the case with us, they learn how to try cases, and that way they can kind of do it on their own.
So let's talk
on.
About like more of the administrative side, which almost all of my
boring.
Time is admin. Boring stuff.
Nerd.
Almost all my time is administrative. I know Sam's probably 100% is admin stuff. So some of the – when people are coming out and they want to start their own law firm, there are kind of things that are low cost that you can probably do to help your business. So like Sam – or anybody. Has anyone – Mar, have you ever opened an office and you just – it's like it's an executive suite?
Yeah, I have one of those out in Palm Desert.
I'm not talking about like a motel. I'm talking about like an executive suite.
My wife might listen to this. You know I'm happily married. But
you bring out the best of it, Mark.
Thank you. Now, I have an executive suite in Palm Desert because my brother lives out there. and he knows the BI business, and sometimes we have cases out there, and so my brother will meet with clients out there for me on occasion and things like that. So we have an executive, we have an address and a phone number, and it helps with, I'm the worst when it comes to internet stuff and all the, how it works, but if you have an actual address and a phone number that's real, I think it makes a difference on Google. That's what I'm told anyways. But yes, we do have that, but I have three offices that actually have people. They're real manned offices.
And woman. So yeah, one of the questions we did have, and it was Brad, was actually to me. Your firm has a lot of locations. Are these mail drops? Are people in there? How do you work on the same cases together? So that I can answer that. It was addressed to me. We do have a lot of offices, and all of our offices have actual humans in there, like actual males and females.
Yes.
But with technology now, everyone can work on the same server. Everyone can be on the same phone system, and you could. We have our receptionist in Hermosa Beach that gets all of our calls and can patch them through to me in Seal Beach or Santa Ana or Woodland Hills or even San Jose. We're all on the same system, logging into the same terminal server in real time. So I think that Ryan, let's say you're going to start your own law firm. Are there anything you would recommend that this is low cost and we can get away with doing this? It might be a temporary fix, or it could be a long-term solution that you're looking at. Like, this is probably the way to go.
My first office was a mailbox. Just that's it. I worked from home and did a mailbox. My second office was a chair in the back of my buddy's office with like a little counter space that I would sit there, and I would go, you know, I'd go outside to make phone calls so I didn't annoy him because he was so close to me. And now I've got, you know, about half of a big suite. So yeah, I've tried to stay lean and mean. I don't really have any special software. I have me and my paralegal and one other lawyer.
And Jenny, when you were doing your own, like, were you working at home, or did you have an office space, and how did that work?
I actually had like an executive suite, and so I had access to a conference room if I needed it. And my office was a windowless office. I chose that because it was like $100 cheaper. And I was really trying to be, you know, frugal and make sure I could go the distance before I committed to the window office. But I can say one thing that I think is worth the investment, because it's really not that much, is a really good, in my opinion, a practice management software. Because especially if when you're first starting out, if you don't have a great paralegal yet, those deadlines and dates, I mean, you don't want to mess up on any of those, you know, expert deadlines, discovery deadlines, all that. So that was the one thing that I did invest in. The windowless office was a trade-off to make sure I had really good practice management software.
So we run our law firm mostly on PCs, and Sam, I know you guys are on Mac. Have you had any problems with
no viruses?
No viruses
on your computer.
Yeah, we're
good. Finally, yes. Someone else.
But if you had any challenges with sharing documents from Mac to PC, because, you know, we're taking this perspective of, hey, I'm going to start my own law firm. Should I go PC like exclusively, or is Mac, is that fine now in today's market?
It's 100% fine. And in fact, we use a program called CasePeer that is web-based, but it's secure web-based, so it's on our server, but it doesn't matter. Somebody could come in with a PC into our office and have the same exact screen and have the same exact functionality for basically the one program that runs our firm. It's just not an issue. And as far as getting documents, I mean, Macs right now, they've come a long way. We started using Macs in our office back, I think, in 2007, 2008, and it was, you know, we'd buy these PCs, we'd spend $500 on a PC, and it would crap out, you know, 8 months later. E-machines, remember those?
Yeah.
We bought those cheap, you know, we thought we were saving money. And sometimes, you know, you think you're saving a buck, but really it's going to cost you two or three in the end. So we bought Apples, and now the lifespan of our machine is that much longer. And you can lease some of this equipment, right? So little tip here, you know, you lease it, you can write that off from your taxes, right? That's not a bad thing. Right away, right? Every payment that you make, you're not spending, you know, outlay of cash up front to buy the equipment. So some tricks.
So Mara, what do you guys use for like your intake and phone system? Is it like a physical PBX or whatever that is, or is it something like web-based RingCentral?
We use it's called RingCentral, which is like a web-based phone system. And then we use FileVine, which is a cloud-based practice management software. And everyone, they usually are at the Vegas convention. And it's specifically made for personal injury. So it's a personal injury software system that, like you were saying, you can log in from anywhere. It doesn't matter where your office is. The phone system.
So we have Sam Casebeer, Mauro FileVine.
Casebeer's better.
So, we use RingCentral at our law firm, and we're porting everything over to RingCentral. But we started off because that was a very inexpensive
and it's still
faxing.
You can
fax from your email, and it was very cheap to use RingCentral, but it ended up being one of the better solutions.
I remember when it was still a PBX switch, and James and I were working for a little workers' comp plaintiff's lawyer in Santa Fe Springs, and he had this box on the wall, and that was the PBX switch. And James had so many voicemails that it literally shut down the entire phone system. It jammed up the whole RAM because it had, like, I don't know, like 10 bytes of RAM. And if you had too many voicemails, it would shut down. So today, now the tech is so much better. We use Kerio, which is
Is that Kerio?
K-E-R-I-O. And it's a program that you will install on your own server. And as long as you've got a robust enough server, it's probably the most flexible system you can use because you have maximum control over how it works. And we use it for our entire firm, and it's been great.
All right, so we're getting low on time, but I wanted to get to the last portion of this. And there's challenges with running your own firm, and I just wanted to get everyone's thoughts on, and you can think about it. I'm going to go around the room and start with Ryan. So, Ryan, you're going to be on the shortest leash. The best part about running your own law firm and the worst part about running your own law firm.
The best part, I think, is being able to control your own schedule and, more importantly, pick your own cases. You know, coming from the defense side, you don't get to pick your own cases at all. You know, the case gets assigned to you. I love being able to meet the client and decide, is this somebody that I want to represent? That's definitely the best thing. The most challenging thing is just the stress because the buck stops with you, you know, and you've got a couple people working for you. You guys have a ton of people working for you. You feel responsible to make overhead and all that kind of stuff. So, but I love it. I wouldn't have it any other way.
We'll hop over to Jenny.
Oh, boy. I mean, I think for me, the best thing about having my own law firm was just being able to make a very big change, because where I was at, it was going to be more of the same for the rest of my life, however long I stayed there. So it was just the power of knowing that you can change your life and circumstance. But for me, like, the negative was I actually felt like I had less control over my schedule, because every depot, every mediation, every MSC, everything, that was me going there. You didn't have, you know, I didn't grow yet to the point of having associates. So for me, the negative was just the overwhelming pressure on one person and not having a team to kind of bounce ideas off of.
Mauro?
I think probably the best part is obviously the freedom it gives you to schedule your own life around work. But sometimes, you know, especially in the early days, I would work 7 days a week. I mean, you know, now maybe I'm not grinding as hard as I used to be, but and especially now, like, especially my employees that have been with me for the last 6, 7, 8, 9 years, they must think, oh man, this guy he rolls in and out, and it's like, man, they should have been with me the first 10 years,
yeah,
and I work 7 days a week. But so now, you know, that if you put in the time, there's a lot of rewards to having your own office and your own firm. A lot of rewards that are good, and you can take advantage of that. And the negative is just the, you know, like Ryan was saying, the buck stops with you. I'm responsible for, you know, all these people, and then, you know, I see the, you know, all their health insurance that I and everything. You know, I feel responsible for that. You know what I mean? So yeah, you're responsible for a lot of people in their lives and them taking care of their own families, right? So you want to make sure that you keep all the balls in the air and you keep juggling everything and you keep everybody employed and happy and prospering. Because I've always thought, if the boss is the only one that's making any money, it's probably destined to fail. You know what I mean? At my office, I'm pretty generous with my employees. Hopefully they're listening. I'm pretty generous with my employees and the lawyers that work for me. I like them all to do well. But if we're all doing well, then everybody's happy. It's just, if I'm the only one doing well, I don't think that's really a recipe for success.
And I think I'll jump in because the biggest negative is, Ryan, the buck stops with you and you're responsible. And a lot of my employees are our family members. And if the ship goes down, my mom's on the street. She's not making us coffee in the morning. It's a lot of pressure, but at the same time, the biggest positive is we have control of how this thing goes, and we're able to make the decisions, and we can do fun things. Like I can talk to Teresa about new business venture, and it's cool and it's fun, and we can choose which clients. Like Ryan and I will talk about, should we take this case? Should we not take this case? Bob's like, I love this case. And Ryan's like, here's the 5 grenades you didn't see. But it's fun to make that decision. And it's, you know, for me, biggest thing is control, but the worst thing is also you're in control. What about you, Sam?
Oh, I think what you all have said is spot on. I identify, Mauro, we love our people, right? And so in that sense, it is an enormous burden, right? Because you know that there's a duty not just to cover those essentials, but I feel the strong duty of providing opportunity, right? You've got to keep growing the business to provide your people with a platform where they can develop and become better versions of themselves professionally. So that's one thing. I love having my own schedule, but at the end of the day, the biggest downside is that you're never off, right? You're never off.
Never off.
This right here. Control. Look at this. I put this down for a little minute, and I've got.
You have 400 emails.
Yeah,
Brad. Demands to have USB ports
and
everywhere he goes.
You know, I've been fantasizing about a world where I don't have a smartphone, where I just go back to a dumb phone. But I literally cannot do it by virtue of my position.
And Sam, you travel.
You remember you having a pager and making calls on a payphone? Remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
That's when you were selling drugs.
Joking.
Ha ha ha! Funny time. It was funny.
I think when you're on your own.
Is there nothing sacred here? I mean, can I? No, you know, I'll make sure I never tell you any more of my stories.
I think for me the best part is I get to grow my beard out as long as I want. I can wear whatever I want to the office.
He can play Xbox with Evan every morning in their little MLS soccer league.
No, I mean, there's definitely a freedom to it where you can, not to say that we're not working, you can work when you want to work. You have to work constantly. But you can work from home if you need to. You can work around your schedule and make it work so you can be with your family. Luckily, I work next door to my brother, but I don't want to always have to see him. I can go home and see my wife when I need to and work from home, see my dogs.
And your daughter on the way.
Yeah, she's coming.
When's Aaron
due? January 14th.
Mara, when's your wife due?
December
24th.
So they could be born on the same day.
I hope not.
Christmas.
That's pretty early.
Christmas baby. Worst time to have a
And then the
birthday.
the worst part is, a lot of, you touched on it, is you're responsible when shit goes wrong on a case, especially if it's a case that you know, a referral attorney that trusts you and came to you and trusted their case with you. You're responsible if shit goes south. You have to, like Bob always says, jump on the grenade, put out the fire. It's your brand, it's your name, it's your face on the company. So you're the one who has to stop what you're doing, no matter how important it is, and take care of.
Yeah, a lot of the things that Bob and I, Brandon, are doing are just damage control, jumping on the grenade, and doing the things that we don't want our employees doing. Not because it's bad, but because it loses productivity, and you just have to step in as the face and mop it up. Speaking of mopping it up, Ryan Conger,
I think
you already went.
Yeah, I did.
You already went. So
I think
we're done with you.
You work more. You work harder. You're more attached
fulfilling.
To it, but yeah. It feels better. Yeah. You know, if you're building something for yourself.
And Sam, you travel more than I do, which is amazing.
That's not true.
You were just in Zurich and
Cleveland.
That
Beautiful
was two
Cleveland.
Years ago to Cleveland at the murder hotel.
But it's like my wife makes fun of me. I'm like, when we're booking hotels, we need to have strong Wi-Fi. We need to have places to plug in our phones next to the bed so I can charge my phone while everyone's going to sleep. But
when I'm in Europe, I never sleep. So my family's from Europe, so I go there to visit once in a while. But I never sleep because the work day, because they're 9 hours ahead. So you're up during the day, European time, and then you're up basically all night because that's the that's the work day here. And that, and you wouldn't do, if you were an employee, if you were, let's say, working at Bergner-Murjovsky, you would take your 2 weeks off and you kind of check in once every few days and you'd unplug.
I remember being in Scotland and waking up to probably 200 WhatsApp messages, and I scrolled to the first one and they were waiting on a verdict, and then like verdict came in 5 minutes. I'm like, well, we got defensed. And then I was about to go back to sleep and I like scroll through and I'm like, oh my God. So this was the Pebley case that we had, and I'm looking at it like that verdict was like disputed liability with a ton of things the jury to decide, and they were just like within 5 minutes, bang, gave Sevi and Grayson everything that they asked for. But it was strange because you have to be plugged in, but you also have to get sleep, and that's hard for me.
You know, speaking of Sevi and Grayson, did you hear about the debacle last night at the
Lakers? You mean when you sold them fake Laker tickets last night?
This is I have Lakers season tickets, and the Simon Law Group is a ticket partner of mine. So I sent Bob the tickets for Simon Law Group for this season.
Proceed.
And I forgot to write down the dates of the games that I sent to Bob. So a week ago I said, hey, Bob, can you send me an email with the dates of the games that I sent you, right? Because I have the tickets electronically, right, in my Lakers account. So Bob sent me an email, and it didn't include last night's game. So then I figure, well, I have that game, right?
Scamming the Lakers.
So I couldn't go to the game because I'm burned out from these back-to-back trials, and I know Tom Fair is always up for a Laker game. So I text Tom. I say, hey, Tom, you want these tickets for the Laker game for tonight? Tom's like, yeah, sure. So I emailed the tickets to Tom, and then somehow, and this is the best part, the tickets that I sent to Tom, he got in the game with. And the tickets that Bob gave to Grayson, he also got in the game with.
Same seats.
All four. So there was four tickets that were scanned and good for two seats.
Sounds like a loophole to get into Lakers games.
So we might have four tickets for each game.
And then Grayson got kicked out, right?
No, he didn't get kicked out.
You'll just have to sit on each other's laps.
That's cute.
But interesting story.
All right, everyone. That ends our exciting How to Manage and Grow a Law Firm section of the podcast.
Thank you for having
us. Take us out.
Legal issue that I wish you saw. Your Honor, Mr. Know-It-All. Clear your eyes and I'll show you, cause with this writ I'll share. With this writ I'll share your thousand views. I'll share your thousand views. Publish me up some new case law. Young appellate justice gonna make the call. Falling all over myself to argue perfect points in public policy. Cause with this writ I'll share your thousand views. Yeah. With this writ I'll share your thousand views. Legal issue that I wish you saw. Your Honor, Mr. Know-It-All. Clear your eyes and I'll show you, cause with this writ I'll share. With this writ I'll share your thousand views. With this writ I'll share.